Howdy, folks, and welcome to another webcast from tggeeks.com, where Ben and Keith, the two gay geeks, talk about all aspects of geekdom and nerdery. Sci-fi, comics, film, genre, you name it, we talk about it. I am Keith Lane, your intrepid sound engineer. This week we have another full program. Now I turn it over to Ben for some news.
Previously, we reported that it looked like Marvel Studios was taking a serious look at reviving the Hulk movie franchise by giving the big green guy a third shot at a standalone movie. Well, as Hollywood is prone to do, some big speculation has started to come forward as to which direction this movie might take. When asked about exploring the Planet Hulk storyline, Mark Ruffalo felt that going down that particular road was not necessarily a good idea, despite the enormous popularity that story had with fans. And Joss Whedon had also stated that he was not laying any groundwork for such a possible story idea. However, Drew McWeeny from HitFix recently visited the set of the new Avengers movie, Age of Ultron, and reported that the ending of this movie does feature one element from the Planet Hulk story. Banner continues to play a key role in things in this movie, and when the final war with Ultron spills onto the battlefield and out of the virtual realm, he has a major part to play. Unfortunately, that ends with him on board a Quinjet on his way off the planet with no way to immediately turn things around. He's going to have to ride out the trip, it's pre-programmed, and he can't stop it. Now, it is believed that this will not lead to a standalone Planet Hulk movie. Rather, the ship could be on a rendezvous with Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and share some screen time with them. And this could serve as a setup towards the eventual endgame of this enormous Marvel Cinematic Universe Kevin Feige has been creating with the Avengers 3, and that will presumably deal with Thanos and his Infinity Gauntlet. Again, this is all speculation based on a brief visit by McWeeny to the Ultron set. However, Marvel did not ask McWeeny to take the story down from HitFix, so right now the future of Hulk in the Marvel Universe is anybody's guess. Now, what does this mean for Hulk? Will he be launched in a spaceship at the end of the upcoming Ultron movie? If so, what does this mean regarding a possible standalone Hulk movie for the future? Well, only the future knows. In the meantime, I think it best that we all relax ourselves with some gamma radiation therapy. In Doctor Who news, Stephen Moffat is definitely returning for a Season 8 and possibly for a Season 9 as well. Speaking to Doctor Who magazine, the Grand Moff said, "Sitting here right now, just before the Series 8 finale shooting block, I figured out the cliffhanger to the penultimate episode of the next series, and it's a whopper. Oh, I don't think you'll see this coming." Well, given that there's already speculation regarding the Master showing up for the end of Season 8, we can only assume that this whopper of a cliffhanger is set for Season 9. Whatever it is, we can only hope that it will live up to the hype that Moffat is already putting out there. Lastly, in horror news, the Discovery Channel is looking to explore some centuries-old horror legends all surrounding the marshes of Louisiana. In what might be regarded as a more serious attempt at ghost hunters or mythbusters, Captain Blimp, his first mate Eric, and his nephew Nathan will take a serious look through the marshes of Louisiana and investigate some of the mythical monsters who live in the bayou, as well as examine the destruction they have caused. Each week of this new series will explore a different legend using scientific means in order to try to dispel any myths that might have been passed down from generation to generation, starting with the legend of Alti, Louisiana's version of the Loch Ness Monster. As Blimp and his team try to prove or disprove the existence of Alti, scientists from Tulane University will be conducting their own investigation with the belief that there is a more logical explanation to the hauntings. As the Discovery Channel puts it, it's scientific knowledge versus Cajun know-how. Tune in to The Beasts of the Bayou, premiering on July 10th at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time on the Discovery Channel to find out who uncovers the truth. Now, we also have additional news stories on our website, tggeeks.com, where you can read about Arrow Season 3 casting news, The confirmation by the BBC of not three, but four new episodes of the hit series Sherlock. Clark Gregg on the future of Phil Coulson as well as the future of S.H.I.E.L.D. And Shortcuts to Hell, which is to stream, Freudian slip there, at the Horror TV Net. And now we will take a short break.
You can find culture at the theater. You can find culture in the bottom of an unwashed coffee mug. Or you can find culture on your iPod. Join Brad, Glenn, and Christina on Pod Culture, Equal Opportunity Geekness. Go to www.podculture.net.
Welcome back. We hope you will give Pod Culture a listen. As our tagline says, you name it, we talk about it. This week's special comment by Ben is one of those times we reach into a different area other than sci-fi, comics, film, or genre. Here's Ben.
Now, as I've proudly proclaimed on many occasions, I am a geek. However, being a geek doesn't necessarily mean that my primary focus is all on the fun stuff of sci-fi, comic book, or fantasy genre. And those are the things that are generally associated with the geek culture. Yes, I do love those things. But being a geek can also mean just being deeply passionate about something. A person could be a movie geek, or a car geek, or a photography geek. I happen to also be a music geek. I come from a very musical family, and I've certainly carved out my name in various music circles. Aside from being a singer, I've also studied guitar, which includes classical study, and I've done so for quite a few years, as well as playing keyboards. I've been in a couple of bands, and on the other side of the musical spectrum, have sung in various chorus organizations, performing such masterpieces as Karloff's Carmen of Burana, and most recently, the Brahms Requiem. Now, I'm not sharing this to put myself on a pedestal, but so that you would have a basic understanding of who I am musically and why the subject I'm about to address means so much to me. Kansas. No, not the state. The band. I'm a huge fan of Kansas and have been since 1976 when I first heard the song Carry On Wayward Son. I remember when I first heard Dust in the Wind on the radio and was fascinated by its guitar structure. In fact, at the time, I made a habit of keeping my guitar out and handy so that I could pick it up anytime I wished. And the next time I heard Dust in the Wind on the radio, I quickly picked up my guitar and within 10 minutes figured out how the song was played. Now, I'm not saying this to boast any talent that I may or may not have. I share this to demonstrate my love of the band. Now, I remember purchasing and listening to their massive 1977 album, Point of No Return, and I just played it over and over and over. It thrilled me to discover this particular style of music, which I would then find out was called progressive rock. Now, the hard, aggressive approach to the music spoke to that teenager rock and roll lover in me. But the structure of the songs, both musically and lyrically, spoke to my more artistic side. I loved hearing music which had enormous complex structure, and was even amused at how one piece of music reminded me of Bach's two-part invention. Still, one element that stuck out was the singing, and that was primarily that of Steve Walsh. In the days before music videos or concert videos for home, all we had was the music. I had no idea what this band looked like when performing, or what kind of stage performance Steve Walsh may have employed. All I knew is that this man was a tremendous singer with a vocal range that absolutely blew me away. Over the following years, I collected their entire back catalog and would eagerly go to the local record store to see if there was a new release. Now, I remember hearing about their follow-up studio album called Monolith. I purchased it and couldn't wait to run into my bedroom, shut the door, and place the vinyl on my turntable. This was a completely different sounding album from before, and that actually thrilled me. I loved how this band could continue to reinvent itself and yet remain true to who they were. Finally, I started to hear a song that was penned by Steve Walsh called Angels Have Fallen. Now, while I had been totally enthralled with the songwriting of their keyboardist slash guitarist, Kerry Livgren, I found myself absolutely dazzled by this new song from Steve. It didn't have the heavy orchestral layers that Carrie liked to ride with. No, this song was lean. Verse, chorus, instrumental bridge, each had their own specific structure. And throughout it all, there were these incredible lyrics that spoke to the most basic of human nature and the potential goodness within. Not only were the lyrics gorgeous, but the chorus and the final verse, as sung by Steve, had a beauty that absolutely stunned me. To this day, that has become one of my favorite songs from that album. A year later, they would release what would be, at least for a time, their final album with the original lineup of this beloved band. It was called Audio Visions, and again, like a young child on Christmas morning, eagerly wanting to tear open the presents under the tree, I could not wait to take this home and listen to it. Again, I was presented with a different, yet very familiar sound. Kansas still presented their fans with big thematic songs from Carrie, as well as more personal, human experience songs from Steve. These two worlds of songwriting were perfect counterbalances to each other in this band. Song after song, I was taken on a musical whirlwind of a ride. And then came the final song on this album, Back Door, and it is more than just a song. What I heard was pure poetry set to a soft ballad-like melody. I felt as if I was taking a relaxing ride through rolling hills. Each musical selection of the song had its own gentle lift and then an equally easy fall, all the while building up to an unsuspecting crescendo, as if my car ride then surprised me with a vista like that of the Grand Canyon itself. After the song faded out on the most amazing chorus, I found myself sitting in my room, absolutely breathless from what I had just experienced. This was a musical revelation. Well, later that year, I had the enormous pleasure of actually attending a Kansas concert in support of the Audio Visions album. And again, I had another enormous revelation watching them perform. I saw six incredible musicians, each who could not only perform individually with virtuosic ability, but had the ability to come together like a perfect jigsaw puzzle to create the perfect musical picture. Again, at the front of all of this was Steve Walsh. What I saw is something that I still cannot quite adequately describe. Here was a man in front of his keyboard setup on one end of the stage. Carrie had his keyboard set up on the other. And Steve would not only play his Krumar organ while singing, but he had this athleticism, which made him out to be the consummate showman. Not only would he do kicks and dance while he was singing, but he's probably the only person I know who is capable of doing handstands while playing the organ at the same time. One magical moment saw him playing the first two sections of a fugue on his organ all by himself. The first section with his left hand, the second section with his right. That alone was amazing, but I was left speechless by the fact that he was dancing at the same time. Never before had I seen something like this. To this day, I can look back at those memories I have of that concert and still feel that I have witnessed something that was rather magical that night. So why am I bringing all of this up? Well, it was announced on June 30th that Steve was quitting Kansas. Why? I have no idea. There have been a multitude of theories that are being thrown at as to why he's doing it, ranging from his voice isn't quite what it once was, and let's be honest, he's not in his 30s anymore, to possibly just wanting to retire and spend more time at home than constantly on the road touring. Whatever the reason is, what I do know is that this news was greeted with sadness by all of his fans. And even though two of the original band members will still remain, their manager and drummer Phil Ehart and guitarist Rich Williams, Steve was still the face and the voice of Kansas, and his absence will be deeply felt by not only the band, but by also its fans. So I want to say this to Steve. Wherever your life takes you on your next chapter, I can only hope that you find happiness and fulfillment in whatever you do. I will carry the memories of all the times I've seen Kansas in concert, starting from 1980 all the way through to 2011. And I will always do so with a smile and joy in my heart.
Thanks, Ben. And before we go, here is some information about the Prescott Film Festival.
As we reported last time, if you're in Arizona in July, you might want to check out the Prescott Film Festival July 23rd through 27th. That's just a couple of weeks away at Yavapai Community College. And the events include film screenings, Oxymorons, a one-act play starring Ed Asner and Mark Rydell, wine tasting, as well as a workshop by renowned sci-fi author Alan Dean Foster, who happens to be a resident of Prescott. And he will be there on the importance and impact of the book Dune to the sci-fi world, as well as screen the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune, which is the story of cult film director Alejandro Jodorowsky and his ambitious but ultimately doomed film adaptation of the seminal science fiction novel, and that will be also hosted by Alan Dean Foster. For more information, just go to PrescottFilmFestival.com.
Okay, that should do it. Thanks for listening to this episode of TG Geeks Webcast. I am Keith Lane. For Ben Raginton, I bid you peace.
Cheers.